How's everybody this evening? Good. Alcoholics Anonymous has certainly given me a lot in the 3 years I've been here. I mean, a lot, and I could spend a lot of time on that. But unfortunately, one of the things it didn't give me is my memory back. And I got a paper here, and I'm not going to try to look at it because there's a couple things I want to mention. But I've spoke a couple times before, and I get a little bit of stage fright, and I lock up, and I forget things. So, you know, are the stories disclosed in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now? What it used to be like was just life was miserable, pure misery. Pure misery. That's what it was like. What happened is I went to an AA meeting. What it's like now is more than I could ever bargain or ask for. I mean, I got a life today that I just dreamed about having. You know, it's unbelievable how good things are today. Just tell you a little bit about myself. I was born and raised in Noakesville, Virginia. I was the second to last of nine kids. There's nine of us. And nobody in my family ever drank. Nobody. My mom and dad, they didn't drink. My grandparents on either side, nobody drank. Never seen anybody drunk. Never seen anybody drink. First person I ever seen drunk was myself. And that was at the age of 16. You know, childhood was good, you know. No complaints. Nothing out of the ordinary. Happy. But I think being the eighth one in line, I just got away with so much, you know. I think there were so many kids, you know, like there's another one, you know. I just got away with so much stuff. And I don't know if it was just out of boredom or what, but hanging around some neighborhood kids, and at the age of 16 is when I took my first drink. You know, they say the apple, they say a child is a product of their environment, but I kind of proved that theory not to be true. I do have a sobriety date, the last drink I had. I can't say it's the last drink I'll ever have, because y'all told me we only have today, but that was February 17th, 2010. So a little over 3 years. I do have a home group, and it's Sunday evenings at 6 o'clock is my home group, and it's in Sperryville. So they're having a meeting right now. So it's about 2 or 3 years before I went to my first AA meeting. My wife, I mean, you know, she tried to get me sober for years, and just to calm her down and just to make her quiet and not bother me, I agreed to go see this therapist in Gainesville. Like I say, this is 2 or 3 years before I went to my first AA meeting. So I had to drink quite a bit before I could even get out of the vehicle to go inside. So I go inside, sat there for an hour, might have said 3 or 4 words, left. He made another appointment. A couple weeks later, I went back and had a drink before I went back in. And I went in there, and he told me, he said, you can come here once a week, twice a week, waste your money if you want to. He said, there's nothing I can do to help you, period. He says, what you need is AA. And I've always heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, but had no idea what it was or what it's about. You know, for years and years I heard about it. But what that guy told me, it just went over my plate in my head every day for a couple years. Just every day I played it in my head what he said. And it took me about 2.5 years after he said that to get me to my first AA meeting. But I finally made it. The first meeting I went to was February 16th, It was in Warrenton. It was on a Wednesday night. And again, I had to sit out in the truck and drank just about a fifth of Jack Daniels before I could even walk in there. So I did walk in there, and I was the first, after the meeting was over, I was the first one out the door. And there's a lot of things that happened since that night that really, that I'll talk about in step two, but there's this old timer that chased me across the parking lot. And I tell you what, that dude scared me to death. He asked me my name. I didn't say anything. He asked me where I lived. He said, I said, Amosville. He said, there's a meeting tomorrow night at Little Washington at 8:30. Get there. And if he wouldn't have come out there and said that, I don't know if I would have made it to my second meeting. So I go. It just seemed like an eternity. You know, that meeting Wednesday night, I think it was at 7:30, and the next one, Thursday night, it was 8:30. I mean, what am I supposed to do? I mean, I can't drink for 24 hours, you know. It was, as y'all know, it was difficult. So I show up there at 8:30 at Little Washington, and I could tell right away those people in that room had what I was looking for. I knew it right that night. And they gave me a where and when. They gave me phone numbers. And that night and the next night, Friday night, Saturday night, every time I went to an AA meeting, I kept hearing about all these steps, you know. I mean, I don't want to work. I just wanted to stop drinking, you know. I didn't know I was going to have to come in here and there's going to be homework and have to read and all that crap, you know. I just did not want to do it. But is it odd or is it God? There's just too many coincidences. Somebody approached me after I was in a room for about a month, and he is still my sponsor today. And I was willing to go through any length. I mean, I did not want to live like I was living anymore. So we talked, me and my sponsor, we talked every day, and we started working these steps. Probably the last 2 or 3 years of my drinking, I knew deep down inside I was an alcoholic. I knew I drank too much. I knew people didn't behave like I behaved. Responsible people. I had no idea, though, that my life was unmanageable. Did not have a clue that it was unmanageable, but I knew I drank too much. And I'll just mention a few things that happened over the years that I thought was just normal living, that, you know, unmanageability never factored in. You know, early on, I think I totaled 7 vehicles in 6 different counties. And never got a DWI. I have never gotten a DWI. And I think Fauquier County and Prince William County, I think back in the 80s, I don't know if they didn't write them or what happened, but of course I was drunk every time when I had those accidents. And seen some of my friends, or if not friends, drinking and partying, people I party with early on, seen quite a few of them leave this world, auto accidents, overdoses, and that type of stuff. But I didn't view any of that as being unmanageable. You know, I just thought that's the way life was. WTOP the other day, it's a news station, they were given a definition of a binge drinker. And WTOP said their definition was a binge drinker, and anybody that could sit down at one time and have 7 drinks. I said, wow. I guess it was 2 ounces, two fluid ounces, 7 of them. And I'm thinking, wow, I'm a daily binge drinker. And and I was a blackout drinker from day one. Just a blackout drinker. And I remember that first day. I know I'm kind of all over the place here, but when I was 16 and I took that first drink, it was a six-pack of Schlitz. And from that moment on, I mean, it was off to the races. I mean, it was just, that's what I don't even know if I was looking for it, but it was so good, you know. It was just on from there. I mean, it was, the race was on. I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm only going to mention this just for a brief second. At the age 19, I discovered drugs. Did just about everyone you can think of or mention, and I drank and did that for the next 10 years. So at the age of 29 or 30, things were starting to crack down at work, and so I gave all the drugs up and haven't touched any since then. And I figured I could continue to drink, right, because it's legal. There's nothing they can do. I can drink. Because I had to protect my job because I had to have income to drink. So I had to protect all that. And I've had the same job for 26 years. And drank every day. Drank every day for those 26 years that I worked. So about the age 30, when I gave all that up, I met my wife about at the same time. We got married, been married, I guess, since 97. I don't know, is that 15, 16 years or whatever. The first 4 or 5 years was really, really good. Still drank every day. And the drinking really, really escalated the last 11, 12 years. Really escalated, you know. Didn't drink beer anymore. It was just nothing but bourbon, massive amounts. I remember stopping by the liquor store, and every day, right, I would stop there every day, and I would tell myself every day, I'm not going to open this until I get home. I couldn't even make it out of the parking lot. And I'd throw up all over inside the vehicle, take that first drink, and just, you know, threw up everywhere. I had this spray bottle with diesel fuel, and I would spray in there, you know, because I worked construction, and I figured, if the man pulls me over, he ain't going to smell all that liquor on inside this truck, you know. He's going to smell his diesel fuel. But you know what? Life's not, you know, to me, that's not unmanageability, right? I thought that was normal living. The last couple years of my drinking, I slept in a guest room. I would keep a glass on my nightstand because I knew I only ate one meal a day. I just ate lunch. That's it. I didn't eat, never ate dinner, never ate breakfast, I ate lunch. Because if I ate dinner, it interfered with my drinking. So I kept this glass on my nightstand, and because in the middle of the night, whether it was if I passed out on a couch, wherever I laid, I took that glass with me because I knew I would vomit in the middle of the night, and I'd fill that glass back up with bourbon. And when I got up the next morning, I'd have to drink it to start my day, so I couldn't waste good bourbon. But there's nothing unmanageable about that. So me and my wife, we were residing in Noakesville. My whole family lives there. They're really great people. But Jesus, I mean, they come by too much. They come by my house too much, you know, and they want to visit. And so that interfered with my drinking. So I said, I'll put a stop to this. I'll move away. So I did the geographical move so I could drink more. So I moved about an hour west out in right there on the Culpeper-Rappahannock County line. And to get away from them. And by golly, they didn't come out there. So I built a garage with no windows in it so I could put my vehicles in there. The stereo did not play anymore. Life, you know, The window, all the blinds in the house were shut, the vehicles in the garage, and my mom and dad would come up and knock on the door, and I wouldn't answer the door. I mean, what is that? I mean, I still had no idea that my life was unmanageable. Back in 2008, 2009, I started to get sick a lot. That was probably 2008. I was in and out of the hospitals a lot. The doctors kept telling me that you need to quit drinking, you need to quit drinking, this is going to kill you, but I wouldn't listen, so I kept drinking. And finally, I got sick pretty bad one day, and they took me to the hospital, and they ran a test or two, and they said, you know, you need to go to Charlottesville in 2 days. We already called down there. They're waiting for you. You know, we found a tumor on your pancreas, and you need to go to UVA. So 2 days later, I go down there, and they did their biopsy and all that, and they said surgery in about 8 days, and it's not looking good for you, Mr. Poole. It's not looking good. The chances of you making it are not good. They're slim. I lit up like a Christmas tree. My wife was there. I was so happy. I was so relieved that that life was over. I mean, I could check out, and everybody think, oh, yeah, he got sick, you know, blah, blah, blah. He's checked out. And I mean, it was probably the best news I've heard in quite some time. Oh, it was just wonderful to hear that because I knew it was over, the misery. So I went to surgery. The surgery lasted 11 and a half hours. That's where they take a half your stomach out, two-thirds of your pancreas, 12 feet of intestines. They take your gallbladder out, your bile duct, your duodenum duct. Before I got sick, I weighed 189 pounds, and when I left the University of Virginia Hospital, I weighed 138. So I survived it, you know. They kept me down there for about a week. I went home. They gave me, I really wasn't much on pills. I mean, I didn't seek them out. But they gave me these pills that were called Dilaudid. And man, were they good. God. I did the math, you know, coming up the road, you know, I did the math, you know, for pain, you got to take so many every 2 hours or whatever. And I did the math, and they gave me enough to last, I think for 16 weeks. I had all those pills done in about 6.5 weeks, taking every one of them. I called the University of Virginia and told them I needed more, and they said, you're not getting any more. They said, deal with it. They said, don't call your doctors in Warrenton or Manassas, because we already called them. They're not giving you none either. I said, all right, I'll show them. So I went straight to a liquor store and bought a fifth and continued to drink for 7 more months after that. Because I told myself, I convinced myself, you know, they got everything bad out. You know, I was good to go. I was healed, you know, and I just couldn't stop drinking. So when the pills ran out, I just went right back to drinking. I just could not stop drinking. You know, I actually called some of these rehab places, and they wanted me to stay there, you know. They want you to stay there for like 4 weeks or something. There's no way that's happening. It's not going to happen. So after that surgery, like I said, I drank for 7 more months, and it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. The last couple of years of my drinking, I thought about dying. I thought about suicide every day. I only did two things. The only thing I did was drink and go to work. That's all I did, period. Drink and go to work. I'd rather pick up the bottle than even look at my wife. There'd be months and months at a time I wouldn't even speak to her. And I can't even stand up here and describe how miserable life was. It was just absolute drudgery. I mean, just absolute misery. So on the 15th of February, a couple of days before I went to the little Washington meeting, I played Russian roulette in front of my wife. And she said, "There's no shell in there." I said, I opened up the cylinder and one fell out on the floor. And that's when she packed her stuff and she was out the door. And I woke up the next morning on that couch. And she was gone and I went to work. And I didn't see her for 7 weeks. She went to her sister's house. So I started going to AA. And it didn't take me long to come into these meetings that I finally realized that, yeah, my life was unmanageable. You know, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. I knew that coming in. Finally, it dawned on me about the unmanageability part. Step two, you know, we came to believe that a power greater than us could restore us to sanity. Boy, that step took some time. I mean, it took some time. Step one, they say step one's the only step you got to get right. I've heard people in the program say they worked a step a month. You know, I'm so glad of the way my sponsor handled this. You know, he didn't put no pressure on me. You got to get this done. You got to get it done. Get to the next step. He's been sober a long time. And, so he let me work these steps at my pace. And it took me about a year to really, really grab a hold of step two. And what I like about that step is that first word, came to believe. Not you will believe, you shall believe, you better believe. That's what I heard when I was a kid. I forgot to mention this. When I was growing up, living in my house was like Little House on the Prairie with Billy Graham as your father. My dad was a preacher, and I just heard that all the time, you know. Not once growing up did my parents set us down and have a conversation about the dangers of alcohol and drugs. Not once, ever, ever. But there was probably 1,000 of those us setting us down and talking about premarital sex. Had plenty of those conversations. Because that'll send you straight to hell. And so my higher power that I understand and understands me, when I took that first drink, you know, I went to church all the time as a kid, but when I took that first drink for the next 29 years, all that crap was out the window. Never stepped foot back inside of a church for probably over 30 years. And but I come to this program and I look at step two, and it, like I said, it took a while. There was just stuff started happening in my life in that year. Things just started happening, and it was just too many coincidences going on. Just too much stuff going on. I'll give you an example. I was probably about 3 months into this journey, and this is before I had a good network. I got a huge network of people now. I call somebody every day. But 3 months into this thing, it was really, really difficult for me to pick up the phone and call anybody. I was just scared to frickin' death of calling anybody. Then I was on 29 there in Gainesville, and I was about 3 months into this journey, and I said, "I'm done. I'm heading to the liquor store. I'm done. I can't do this." And so I'm in the left turn lane, and there's a car in front of me, and that license plate on that car said Serenity. S-E-R-E-N-T-Y. And I was just staring at that plate. Then I heard all these horns blowing. I looked up and there wasn't a car in front of me nowhere, and there was a line behind me. So I just hit the gas and took off and stayed on 29 and heading to Warrenton. But I convinced myself that seeing that tag didn't mean a whole lot, so I was going to stop at the liquor store in Warrenton. So I get to Warrenton and get in that right-hand turn lane. There's a car in front of me, and that license plate said newcomer. N-E-W-C-O-M-R. That sounds far-fetched. I'm here to tell you, it happened. It absolutely happened. And that was enough that day for me not wanting to pick up a drink. You know? And that plays into part of that first word step to came to believe. And something else had happened. I was probably 4 months into this program, and my sponsor gave me a daily reflections book up in Hume one night. I think it was a Saturday night. So I took that book home, and that date, I think it was either March or April, and I turned to that day that it was. And the very first line said, alcoholism required me to drink whether I wanted to or not. Something that simple, that clicked with me. That's all I could think about it. It's like, God, maybe this alcoholism is a real thing. I mean, you people are telling me it's a disease. I mean, it's not cancer, it's not leukemia. But just reading that, something clicked in my head, and it's like that loophole, you know? And I could just really, really relate to that because it did require me to drink. I could not stop drinking. Period. I mean, there was no way I could stop drinking when I was drinking. Every morning, it was just like Groundhog Day. Every morning, I said, this is it. This is the morning I'm not going to drink. This is it. I could not go more in the day. You know, I was a daily drinker. I just could not stop drinking. And so there's a lot of those coincidences like that. And like I say, it took me a year to really wrap my head around step two. There was a lot of more. I can't really think of any more right now, but there's a lot of stuff is, you know, you hear, is it odd? Is it God? Too many coincidences. So finally I was able to wrap my head around step two. Then step three, made a decision to turn my will and my life over. And that's exactly what I did. Which led me to step four. That took some time as well. Not as long as step two did, but it's something I really, really put a lot of thought behind and wrote some stuff down. I wrote some stuff on that paper I thought I would never even say to anybody. You know, stuff that happened over the years. I had no idea where it was even coming from. You know, these skeletons, these secrets, all this stuff. And I just wrote it on the paper. My sponsor, he lives over in Fairfax. It was a Saturday. He said, come on over Saturday and we'll work on this step five. So I got over about 11 o'clock. We had an early lunch, go back to his place. It's about 12:15. I figured a couple hours, I'll be out of here. And I think it was 7 o'clock I left that night. And I'm going to tell you what an experience. God, I mean, I know I'm not supposed to put anybody on a pedestal, but my sponsor's more than a sponsor. He's just a good friend, just a good guy. And I learned so much that day. And all those different individual things that I wrote on that paper, I mean, he just like, we concentrated on one after the other and just analyzed stuff and what my part in it. And just, I left there just feeling like a new person. It was unbelievable. And I told Gary, I said, I guess we better go outside and burn this paper. I can't take this home with me, you know. He said, I wish you really wouldn't do that. He said, I kind of want to hang on to this paper. Can I keep it? And all these thoughts went through my head. What's he want to do with this paper? Is he going to try to get me over or give it to my wife or whatever? And I said, sure, Gary, you keep it. Do whatever you want. You keep it. And we got to talk there in a minute about that, what he did with it later here in a few minutes. But when I was 14 months into this journey, my father died. Kind of expecting that he'd been sick for a while. So I was 14 months sober. He passed away. All those people, you know, back when I was partying, I truly, truly met a lot of people, you know, did drugs with, drank with, all that stuff. At my father's funeral, there, not one of those people were there, not one. The people from Alcoholics Anonymous, there was 27 of them there. Just unbelievable. And that was a tough time, you know, and I didn't have to pick up a drink. I mean, those people in this fellowship were there for me. 3 months later, my mother died. And they were married for 65 years. Can you believe that? Mm-hmm. Jesus. I just, more power to them. I don't know. It feels like I've been married that long, but I don't know. They say some people die of a broken or lonely heart or whatever. My mom was in pretty good shape, you know. Her health wasn't that bad. Pretty good, actually, and her mind was there. And a couple weeks before she died, she says, Danny, I'm out of here. I said, what are you talking about? You're out of here. She says, it's time for me to check out. She says, I'm going to go see your father. And that's all I got to say. So a couple weeks later, that's what happened. And again, at that funeral, I think it was over, you know, the sign-in book you sign. I think a couple weeks later, I looked at that book and there was over 30 names that I recognized from this program. And I didn't have to pick up a drink and dealing with any of that stuff, you know. The people of this fellowship were there for me. They just surrounded me, you know, just was there for me. I know I'm forgetting something, but anyway, time went on, and I was working on my step number 8 list. So again, I go over to my sponsor's place. We looked at the list that I wrote for my step 8, right? Then he pulled out the step 4 list. I said, wow, this guy knew what he was doing. It just amazed me hanging out with you folks, right? And going to these meetings every day. This is what I do now. This is what I do now. When I was drinking, I drank and went to work. Now I work and go to meetings. This program is my life now, which it's allowed me to do other things. You know, my wife moved back in. Golly, we got a relationship now that was like it was when we were first married. We can communicate. There's no arguing. I was never a violent person. I mean, look at me. Who am I beating up, right? And so I didn't get physical, but there's a lot of verbal and emotional abuse to her. But time takes time. Time heals all wounds. And I tell you what, it's truly gotten better. But anyway, when Gary brought out that list on step four, it's just amazing how much growth that has happened since we did step five and then we were looking at step eight. A lot of people that was on that step four list, it just didn't seem very important. You know, we went through the whole list and, you know, you don't need to make amends of this and scratch that one off. And it was just quite the experience of, boy, it's amazing to see how much one can grow in that amount of time. And I'm certainly glad he kept that piece of paper. Life is really good today. I mean, this program has allowed me to be a participant in life. I could just go down a list and name all kinds of stuff. You know, how it's restored my confidence. It's restored self-esteem. People can trust me. I can trust people. The list just goes on and on and on. What this program has given to me. And I'm not talking material things. I'm talking to things that really, really matter in life. I think Sam said wrap it up about, what, quarter till? So, I like to talk about something that's really, really important to me in this program, and that is service work. When I first came around here, I had like three coffee-making jobs. I knew immediately that my home group was going to be Sperryville Sunday evenings at 6, if y'all ever get a chance, come up and visit. So a couple home group members there asked me to chair that meeting. So I chaired that meeting for a year. I didn't really, really want to do it, you know, jump in with both feet, but I kind of thought I didn't really want to do any service work. But I don't even know if I would have, the growth that I'm at now, or if I would have even become around if it wasn't for the service work. I mean, it's that important to me. So I became a GS after my year was up as a chair in the meeting. They wanted me to be a GSR. So I'm the GSR of my group. And here about a month or two ago, I was elected to treasurer of the Blue Ridge Area Intergroup. You know what? About a year and a half ago, when my sponsor took me up there to that Blue Ridge Area Intergroup up there in Winchester, I knew that night he was up to something. And I tried to put it off. I tried to put it off as long as I could, but I just couldn't. And again, he knew what he was doing. He knew what I needed. And service work is really, really important to me. There's this one story that I spoke a couple times. I only shared this once. The last time or two I spoke, I left this story out. I'm going to go ahead and tell it real quick. We had a part, that 10-year part when I was also doing drugs. Because my career started with drinking and it ended with drinking. I worked at a local hospital back when I was 20, 21 years old. And this other guy that worked there, we partied on the job together, of course. And he says, man, you got to come in here and check this out. So I went in there and he said, what's this? It was nitrous oxide. And it was one of those industrial, you know, like you weld with. I mean, it just wasn't a little propane tank. I mean, this thing was, it was either 100 pound or 100 gallon. It stood this tall, about yay big around. I mean, it was serious nitrous. And so he said, this is how you do it. You know, you take a big inhale, and I did it, and I fell on the floor, started shaking. I said, this is where it's at. So I had to have it. You know, I had to have it. And, I mean, who gets addicted to nitrous oxide? So that night, I asked him if he wanted to help me come back to the hospital and get it, and he said no. I said, all right. I wasn't much growing up, I wasn't much on being a thief or stealing. But I would steal your drink. I would steal your drugs. And I would do that. But so I went to the hospital, and I packed right up to the place. It was like 2 in the morning, like I owned it, and put the tank in the truck and drove away. And that tank rolled around in the back of my truck for like 3 months. And I would just be, I'd stop anywhere and just, it's a wonder. I was thinking about actually running a hose up to the cab. But I just, God, I just love that stuff. And then I was up on the Shenandoah River one evening, and I was there with my bottle, my big metal bottle. And I passed out, and when I woke up, the valve was left on, and it was empty. Yeah, it was devastating. So I just rolled it down the hill right into the Shenandoah River, and it just floated away. So I tell that story every once in a while. But anyway, I think that's all I got. Thank you all so much for letting me come up here this evening. Thanks.